Hello. Michelle, are you on the phone? How are you this morning? Okay. All right. So I'll meet you down at the table. All right. I'll be down soon. Right. Michelle, are you on the phone?
No, this is Becky. Good
Hey,
morning.
Kath. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We'll get started in a couple minutes, folks.
Hi, Howard. It's Ann Welsh.
Hey, Ann. How are you?
I'm doing well, especially with this lovely sunshine, finally. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. I'm not in my office today, so I'm doing this remotely.
Oh, okay. So the big word came down about FLSA.
Yep. Well, I've been telling everybody it would, so here we are.
Good morning, it's Ann Barnes.
Ann, how are you?
Hey, Howard.
How's it going?
Good, good. We're rocking and rolling over here in this company.
Yes, you are. I'm reading about you all the time.
I was received in the mail last night by overnight delivery a mailing from Gannett about voting at the shareholders meeting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, for my... The amount of stock that I own doesn't even equal $100. I think it's like 10 shares.
Well, every vote counts, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. Well, I'm actually at a judicial conference at the Greenbrier.
Nice.
This morning, Chief Justice Roberts is speaking, so should be nice.
That will be fascinating.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I won that conference call.
Hello.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to hear what he has to say about the status of the court right now, Howard.
I'm not sure he'll speak to that, honestly.
He probably won't.
You know, I think they try and stay away from some controversial things, but yeah, it'll be nice to hear him. He was actually at a cocktail party last night.
How neat.
Along with his three Secret Service guys.
Yeah, oh, well, they all have Secret Service.
I know. All right. Well, it's 9:02, so we got stuff to cover. We're going to get started. Good morning to everybody. It's Howard Kerman. Hopefully everybody can hear me okay. I'm not in my office, but it should be okay. If you can't, let me know. There's plenty to report today. I wanted to start off with a press release that was issued by the EEOC on May the 9th, and I'll read a little bit about it. And then I want to actually go into some detail because I think it may be helpful to those of you who have issues about extending leave or when a person is coming back from leave with a disability and what your obligations are, at least according to the EEOC. So on May the 9th, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission said today issued a new resource document that addresses the rights of employees with disabilities who seek leave as a reasonable accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities Act. The doc...
Uh-oh.
The document is entitled Employer-Provided Leave and the Americans with Disabilities Act. I would invite all of you essentially to download this from the EEOC's website. And as the EEOC says, disability charges filed with the EEOC reached a new high in fiscal year 2015, increasing over 5% from the previous year. They go on to say, one troubling trend the EEOC has identified in ADA charges is the prevalence of employer policies that deny or unlawfully restrict the use of leave as a reasonable accommodation. And they go on to say, providing employees with a period of leave for medical treatment or recovery can be a critical reasonable accommodation for people with disabilities. Now, again, you can download the entire document from the EOC's website, but this morning I wanted to highlight certain areas from this guidance that the EEOC has put out. Now, remember, this is an EEOC guidance. It's not necessarily something that all courts will defer to in terms of everything that the EEOC has said, but they may. And so for that reason, I wanted to make you aware of certain statements that are in this document, which is a fairly long document, but I would encourage you, particularly those of you who have responsibilities for ascertaining the ability of an employee to come back after leave or what the job requires, all of you may want to take a look at this protracted and long document. So let me go over some of the statements that they've made in this document. The EEOC says, employer policies that require employees on extended leave to be 100% healed or able to work without restrictions may deny employees reasonable accommodations that would enable them to return to work. Employers also sometimes fail to consider reassignment as an option for employees with disabilities who cannot return to their jobs following leave. The explanation proceeds, and it says, the purpose of the ADA's reasonable accommodation obligation is to require employers to change the way things are customarily done to enable employees with disabilities to work. Leave as a reasonable accommodation is consistent with this purpose when it enables an employee to return to work following the period of leave. And they go on to say, an employer must consider providing unpaid leave to an employee with a disability as a reasonable accommodation if the employee requires it, and so long as it does not create an undue hardship for the employer. I'll come back to that in a little bit. So they give several examples. One example is an employer's leave policy does not cover employees until they have worked for 6 months. An employee who has worked for only 3 months requires 4 weeks of leave for treatment for a disability. Although the employee is ineligible for leave under the employer's leave policy, the employer must provide unpaid leave as a reasonable accommodation unless it can show that providing the unpaid leave would cause undue hardship. Another example, an employer's leave policy does not cover employees who work fewer than 30 hours per week. An employee who works 25 hours per week and who has not worked enough hours to be eligible for leave under the FMLA requests 1 day of leave each week for the next 3 months for treatment of a disability. The employer must provide unpaid leave as a reasonable accommodation unless it can show that providing the unpaid leave would cause undue hardship. They go on and provide other examples for those of you who have maximum leave policy. So for instance, they say the ADA requires that employers make exceptions to their policies, including leave policies, in order to provide a reasonable accommodation. Although employers are allowed to have leave policies that establish the maximum amount of leave an employer will provide or permit, they may have to grant leave beyond this amount as a reasonable accommodation to employees who require it because of a disability unless the employer can show that doing so will cause an undue hardship. And they include this example. An employer covered under the FMLA grants employees a maximum of 12 weeks of leave per year. An employee uses the full 12 weeks of FMLA leave for her disability, but still needs an additional 5 weeks of leave. The employer must provide the additional leave as a reasonable accommodation unless the employer can show that doing so will cause an undue hardship. Same thing They go on to say, an employer will violate the ADA if it requires an employee with a disability to have no medical restrictions, that is, be 100% healed or recovered, if the employee can perform her job with or without reasonable accommodation, unless the employer can show providing the needed accommodation would cause an undue hardship. Now, when they talk about undue hardship, and by the way, they also talk about reassignment as an accommodation. When they talk about undue hardship, they list several factors that an employer would consider. One is the amount and or length of leave required. For example, 4 months, 3 days per week, 6 days per week, etc. The second is the frequency of the leave. For example, 3 days per week, 3 days per month, every Thursday. The third is whether there is any flexibility with respect to the days on which leave is taken. For example, whether treatment normally provided on a Monday could be provided on some other day during the week. Another example, the impact of the employee's absence on coworkers and on whether specific job duties are being performed in an appropriate and timely manner. There are other things that are contained in this long treatment. But I think the takeaway for all of you who have any responsibilities for evaluating the return of an employee from leave is that it really is an individualistic analysis based upon the particular circumstance of the employee. So if an employee has taken his or her 12 weeks of FMLA leave and may need 2 or 3 weeks additional to deal with the disability under the ADA, you may very well have an obligation, irrespective of the fact that the employee has used up his or her FMLA leave, to accommodate it. On the other hand, if you get what often happens, you get an amorphous or an ambiguous statement from a physician that says it is indeterminate when employee A may be able to return after the 12 weeks of FMLA leave, then you think you can make a very good argument that in that situation you don't have a duty to accommodate because it would impose an undue hardship on the individual employer to accommodate that particular disability. But the point is, blanket policies, which would otherwise prohibit the extension of a leave in a certain circumstance, either because you have an independent policy that says you're only entitled to X amount of days or leave per year, or an FMLA policy that says at the end of 12 weeks, if you don't return to work, you'll be terminated, may not be applicable, particularly if it's up to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And this is the kind of thing where courts probably would be somewhat deferential to the EEOC's guidelines, because it's a multi-factored analysis that deals with the nature of the disability, the nature of the accommodation, and the nature of any putative hardship that would be imposed upon the employer. So I invite you to take a good look at and download this from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's website. It's worth reading, and certainly if you have responsibility, either direct or indirect, for how employees are treated upon their return from their leave, I think you need to become familiar with the EEOC's guidelines. Not a surprising turn, as I've been talking about this for weeks, if not months, the Department of Labor finalized its rule on the change of salary for the white-collar exemptions, which was issued on May 18th, late in the day, by the way, on May 18th, 2016. So just to summarize for those of you, I'm sure you've probably read this, but I'll just summarize for you. The DOL raises the threshold from $455 a week, which was the old test going back many years, to $913 per week, which comes out to about $47,500 per year, which was maybe $2,500 less than what they originally thought. This was the grand compromise by the Department of Labor. The DOL justifies it by coming up with this level and saying that it is the equivalent of the 40th percentile of earnings of full-time salary employees in the lowest wage census region, which is right now in the south of the United States. Secondly, the DOL rules permit employers to include non-discretionary bonuses, that's non-discretionary bonuses and incentive payments, which would include commissions, to account for or be attributable for up to 10% of the new adjusted required salary level. Thirdly, the DOL rules raise the compensation level for those, in quotes, highly compensated employees, close quotes, to the annual equivalent of the 90th percentile of full-time salaried workers nationally, which currently is $134,000. Fourth, in the draft of the DOL rules, which were first published, they wanted to update the salary and compensation thresholds every year. The business community shouted loud and clear, and as a result of that, the DOL now, under the final rule, says that they will automatically update the salary and compensation thresholds every 3 years. Significantly, it was always rumored that the DOL wanted to change the duties test. As you know, in order to be exempt as an administrative or an executive or professional employee, there's not only a salary test, but there's a duties test as well for each of those particular subclassifications. And it was rumored for many weeks and months that the DOL would determine that they needed to change the duties test. For instance, in California, in order to be considered exempt under the state California law, you have to perform 50% of your duties in an exempt classification. Well, the DOL backed off of that, and the final rule contains no other changes in the duties test beyond those which are enumerated in the FLSA regulations. So, I mean, we knew that these were coming. Rather than these regulations becoming effective immediately, they will be effective December the 1st of this year. And I think that it gives employers and you all out there plenty of time, frankly, to decide what you want to do, how you want to go about adjusting this, whether you want to convert existing exempt employees to non-exempt hourly employees. Remember, if you have an exempt employee that you're classifying as an exempt salaried employee, and that exempt salaried employee is only making $38,000, under the new rules, you wouldn't need to adjust that unless you think that that person's going to be working overtime. If the person's going to be working overtime, then, of course, you need to treat that person as a non-exempt employee. But you need to really go through, and you really, as I've preached numerous times before, you take a good look at your workforce, good look at your exemptions, and good look at your job descriptions and determine what you want to do, because there's a morale issue, as I've talked about before, in converting exempt employees to non-exempt, in that they no longer have the workplace flexibility that they did, and just their self-image as a professional exempt employee takes a hit once they're converted to a non-exempt hourly employee. So we are where we are. It's not a surprise. The only surprise was that the DOL, at least in part, listened to what the employer community was saying and made no changes in the duty test and minimally reduced the salary test from $150,000 to $147,000. So we're just going to see how this plays out. But I think in the end, proactive employers, again, have between now and December 1st, which is plenty of time in order to adjust their compensation and salary levels. And if you need some help on that, I'd be glad to assist you with that. To show you how aggressive the Department of Labor is, came across one of their press releases just last week. It was May 16th. And it's interesting. They say that the message that workers deserve to be paid what they're owed, that is, if an employer chooses to ignore that responsibility, we're serious about stepping in to make it right. case in point, several years ago we investigated, and they name it, Enterprise Laundry Services in Chicago, and discovered that the company violated the FLSA's minimum wage overtime and record-keeping provisions. Most employers in this situation take immediate steps to pay workers that they are owed and to put safeguards in place to make sure those kinds of violations don't happen again. But since then, this laundry company, and they name the owner, Margaret Matkowska, refused to comply with three court orders to pay back wages and damages to 61 workers who had been shorted. Fines for civil contempt are outstanding, bringing the total amount owed to $249,426. And that's not even the worst of it. We discovered that Matkowska has spent $47,000 in corporate and personal funds since November by gambling and making large cash withdrawals at four casinos, sometimes even using corporate payroll accounts to pay for her gambling habit. Employers should know that we will use every tool available, including litigation, to make sure workers receive the money they have rightfully earned. I found this to be interesting because it's one thing for the DOL to come across and to essentially indicate to employers that they have cases pending and generally describe what those cases are. It's another thing to name the company, name the owner, name the specifics of what's going on. And I just think it is indicative of how aggressive this Department of Labor is, as well as the other employment administrative agencies like the EOC and the NLRB. And this is on a public press release. So talking about shaming an employer, this is about as bad as it gets. Again, I think it's indicative of the fact that the Department of Labor now, and of course, if we have another Democratic candidate elected as president, it probably will continue for the next at least 4 years. So a word to the wise. The last thing that I wanted to mention is those of you who are covered by OSHA. On May the 12th, OSHA issued amendments to its record-keeping regulations. And the new rule basically requires employers, that's large employers, that is employers with 250 more employees that are not exempt from OSHA's record-keeping rules, and high-risk employers, and those are defined on OSHA's website, that not only do they have to keep record-keeping of injuries and illnesses, but the new rule requires that they annually submit these electronic injury and illness data reports directly to OSHA. So as opposed to the past, where OSHA may have audited a company and requested this information, employers now have an affirmative duty annually, if they are covered under the provisions, to submit electronic reports to OSHA. And they also must now affirmatively inform employees that they have the right to report work-related injuries and illnesses to OSHA and without facing any kind of retaliatory action on the part of the employer. Pretty significant. Many of you may not have OSHA issues or may not be covered, but for those of you who are, pay attention to this. It was just issued last week, or May the 12th, and I'm sure you can get the detail about the OSHA record-keeping requirements directly on the OSHA website if you need further information. The last thing I will mention is for those of you who seek to protect trade secrets from your employees, on May 11th, President Obama signed into law the so-called Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2016. And what this statute does is create a new federal private cause of action for trade secret misappropriation, so that previously the remedy for trade secret appropriation on the federal side was a criminal statute. Now, in addition to the criminal statute, there is a civil right of action that employers can go after an employee who has misappropriated trade secrets, get attorney's fees, injunctive relief, and damages. So it's a pretty significant statute. It's gotten a lot of play, particularly among the employment bar. And I think it's probably something that if you are dealing with an employee who you believe has gotten away or misappropriated important trade secrets, it's one that your attorney can use as another sort of arrow in the arsenal against a departing employee who may have departed with valuable trade secrets. So again, this is something that may not concern many of you, but for those of you who have post-employment agreements with individuals concerning trade secrets or expose employees to trade secrets, this is something that you're going to want to become familiar with. Okay, a lot of stuff that I reviewed today. As always, any questions or comments are welcome. If you'd rather do it individually, my direct phone number is 410-209-6417, email hkerman, H-K-U-R-M-A-N, at Offit, O-F-F-I-T, kerman.com. Any questions or comments out there?
Big stuff, Howard. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? If not, I hope that we're in for some sunny days and a good Memorial Day, because God knows, I think we all deserve it, that's for sure. And, you know, have a safe and a good Memorial Day, and we'll reconvene on June the 8th.
Yeah, Howard,
thanks,
thank
everybody.
You.
Thanks,
Take
Howard.
Care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye.